When the sun set, Finley refused to go to sleep, satisfied that once he closed his eyes, this Campbell would cut his throat. Instead, he sat against a tree, rifle across his knees, and when Otto rolled over at midnight and opened his eyes, there his father waited. They both looked a few feet away to where Zave snored easily, and when the boy arose at dawn, nothing had changed. Campbell was never told of the night-long vigil, but on the 12th day, Finley astonished everyone by blurting out, "Zave, nobody herds cattle better than you. When we reach Texas and get our land, you can have your share. You earned it." "You can build your barn right next to ours," Otto said. "You any idea how big 20,000 acres is, son?" With a twig as chalk and a sandy bank as blackboard, Zave lined it out. 640 acres to a square mile. 640 into 20,000, that's 35, 36, more or less, square miles. That means 6 miles to a side. So my barn ain't gonna be very close to your barn. That day, he showed Otto just how far 6 miles was going to be. "Remember this little stream way back here? I'll reckon the miles as we drive the cattle, but you keep in mind how far away this stream is." And as they walked off the miles, the boy gained his first sense of how vast things in Texas were going to be. He had thought of his future home as a kind of farm. The way Zave explained it, the place would be an empire. Zave then took in hand Otto's real education. "I'm surprised you can't shoot proper. I was your age, I could hit me a sparrow." Using his own long rifle, he taught the boy the tricks of hunting, especially the art of rapid loading. "Can't never tell when that second shot, fired prompt, is gonna turn the trick." He drilled Otto in firing accurately, then reloading at finger-numbing speed. "You got to do it in rhythm, like a dance, and always in the same order. Prop your gun. Right hand, grab your powder horn and pour in just enough. Right hand again, grab the wadding. Left hand, take the ramrod from its place, jam it down the muzzle, tamp down the wadding. Left hand again, ball from the pouch, slide it in. Right hand, take the percussion cap and fix it. Both hands, fire." When Otto began dropping birds and squirrels out of trees and reloading instantly for the next shot, Zave was ecstatic. "McNab, I think we got us a real man on our hands." The hunting experience that Otto would remember longest, however, came early one morning when he was following a squirrel as it leaped through the trees. From the north came a soft whirring sound, which increased until it was a dull, persistent thunder. And when he looked up, he saw coming toward him more birds than he had ever imagined. The sky was dark with them, and as they came in always increasing numbers, the morning sun was blanketed, and a kind of twilight fell over the earth. All morning they came, a flock so great it must have covered entire counties, and even large parts of states, an incredible flight of birds. "Passenger pigeons," Zave said. "Always have flown that way, always will." Once, when the birds were low overhead, he fired a musket at them, and they flew in such packed formation that he brought down 11, and the eating was good. On they went, 2 McNabs, a Campbell, and a dog, droving cattle through lonely and forlorn land, as their ancestors had done for centuries in the highlands of Scotland. And at last they arrived in Natchez, that French, Spanish, English, American town of great beauty, perched high on its hill above the Mississippi, with its squalid row of half a dozen mean streets down on the flats where the great boats docked, where the saloons never closed, where boatmen from Kentucky and Tennessee lost in an hour what they had slaved 4 months to earn. As they drove their cattle along the main streets, lined with expensive and glamorous houses, Otto knew instinctively that he and his companions were not intended to stop there. threatening stares of passers-by in costly clothes told him that. But he was not prepared for what he found when Finley and Zave herded their cattle down the steep streets leading to the waterfront. Now they passed into an entirely different world of sweating black porters, shouting women, steamboats with their engines banked being warped into position side by side, and bands of musicians playing music endlessly. Natchez Under the Hill was its own town of several thousand, and here the commerce of the great river basins, Ohio, Missouri, Mississippi, came temporarily to rest in huge warehouses that groaned with the produce of America. It was an exciting place, a steaming hodgepodge of black and white, of Virginian and New Yorker, of buyer and seller, of slave and free. And many a man who now owned one of the big white-pillared houses on the hill, with many servants proclaiming his wealth, had started buying fish and timber on the wharfs. But it was also a frightening place, with knives flashing in the dark. And Zave Campbell showed young Otto the spot where one of the greatest knife fighters of them all, Jim Bowie of Tennessee, had demonstrated his ferocious skill. Bowie had this fierce knife, and he allowed himself to be tied to a log. And his enemy, he was lashed down too, and there they fought it out, slashing and ducking, and Bowie cut his man to shreds. What did he do then? He asked his brother Rezin to make him an even bigger knife, foot and a half long, with a heavy guard protecting the handle from the blade. Why did he do that? He said, "When you're strapped to a log, you can't have a knife that's too long." "Can I see him? Where is he now?" "Who knows? They run him out of Tennessee." When it came time to arrange for the cattle to move south toward New Orleans, McNabb discovered two painful truths. The cost of taking them by steamboat was prohibitive, and he had wasted his energies bringing them down from Nashville. "Man," he was told, "we find all the cattle we need in New Orleans. They bring 'em in from everywhere." And when Finley pointed out that he intended to take them on to Texas, the speaker guffawed, "Hector, come here and tell the man." Hector was a dumpy fellow in his 40s. He had been to Texas and proposed to return as soon as the two boilers for his sawmill reached Natchez from Pittsburgh, where they had been bolted together and caulked. "Cattle to Texas?" he said. "That's the craziest thing I ever heard of. Cattle run free all over Texas, millions of 'em. I hire two Mexicans to keep the damn things off in my place."
"Are you telling the truth?"
"Come here, Buster." The sawmill man called everyone Buster, and when he had Finley seated on one of the pilings of a wharf, he explained, "Cattle been breeding free in Texas since the creation, or, as some say, since the Spaniards arrove. Cattle everywhere. Big, huge horns. Best-eaten beef God ever made. And, Buster, strike me dead if they ain't all free. You just go out with your lasso."
"What's a lasso?"
"Mexican-style rope. You form it in a loop, and you won't believe me when I tell you what a tricky hand can do with that loop."
"It's hard to believe what you say."
"Texas is different, Buster, and you got to accept it on faith. If you carry them cattle on to Texas, all you can do is give 'em away. You sure as hell can't sell 'em."
"What should I do?"
"I'd sell 'em right here, as beef."
"They won't bring what I paid for them in Nashville," he spat, "and all that trouble on the trace."
The sawmill man clapped him on the shoulder. "Buster, sometimes plans go sour. They promised me, solemn, that my boilers would be here 6 months ago. I'm still waiting, and I'm still paying for my room, such as it is."
McNabb and Campbell spent 5 days trying to reach the best deal on the cattle, and Otto was surprised one afternoon to hear them telling a prospective customer that they had 33 head to sell, for he knew that his father had left Nashville with 30 and had sold 2 to stands along the trace that needed beef. There should be 28 for sale. But what he did not know was that it was physically and morally impossible for a McNabb or a Campbell to pass through territory containing cattle without enlarging his herd. By old established practices, they had acquired an additional 5 head. In the end, they had to sell at a severe loss. But the transaction was not without its benefits, because the buyer was a man who ran a repair shop for steamboats, a kind of inland ship's chandlery. And when through casual conversation he discovered how experienced Findlay was in such matters, he pressed him to accept a job serving the big river boats. At first, Findlay demurred, so the man said, "Help me, and I'll double the price I offered for your beef." This was too gratifying for a trader like McNab to refuse, for, as he explained to Campbell, "We make a neat profit on the animals, and we can save money for our start in Texas." He went back to the man and said, "I'll take the job, but you must employ my friend Campbell, too. He's a mighty worker." I've seen Campbell on other trips. He eats big and works little. He would not hire the big Kaintuck, but McNab did find Zabe a job sweeping out a saloon, and when the three settled in to Natchez under the hill as if it had always been their home, Texas grew farther away. The only problem was Otto. He was 8 now, not much taller than before, and the long tradition of the McNabs required him to get started on his education. But schools were not a major feature of Under the Hill. There were some on the upper level, but it was difficult to get to them, and when Findlay inquired, he was told quite bluntly, "We do not look kindly upon boys from under." There was, however, a woman on the lower level, now married to a roustabout, who had once taught school in the rowdy town of Paducah, when it was still called Pekin, and she said that she could teach Otto reading, writing, and numbers up to the rule of 3. She was a mournful lady, spending much of each class telling the boy of her more fortunate days in Memphis, where her father sold furniture and coffins. But she developed a real liking for the lad, and gave him a rather better education than he might have received in the more fashionable classrooms of the upper level. It was curious, Otto thought, that the two towns were so separate. A person could live his entire life in one, it seemed, without ever venturing into the other. Under the Hill was the bigger, the more flourishing, and also much the wilder. But just as he had discovered on the long walk through Maryland, that civilization could consist of a cabin in the wilderness throwing light and comfort into the darkness, so now he knew where the good life lay in Natchez. It thrived in those big, clean, white houses atop the hill. And whenever they had the chance, he and Zave would climb the steep streets and walk aimlessly beneath the arching trees, looking at the mansions. "You ain't to think, son, that everybody in there is happy," Zave cautioned. And he showed Otto 2 especially fine houses, from which a boy and a girl, desperately and hopelessly in love, had come to Under the Hill to commit suicide. And he also knew which big one had contained the man who had run away to Pittsburgh, abandoning his wife and 2 daughters. "My father ran..." "Don't tell me about it," Campbell thundered. And Otto pondered these complexities. The year 1830 passed, with Findlay earning substantial wages on the waterfront, and with Zave Campbell promoted to bartender, where he could steal from both his boss and his patrons. The trio was prospering financially, but Otto was not advancing in much else, for he had mastered about as much learning as the Paducah woman could dispense, and was beginning to lose interest. Also, he was reaching the age when circumstances might throw him in with the rowdy urchins who pestered ship captains when their boats were tied up. And Otto himself worried about this, because everything he had so far observed inclined him toward an orderly life, away from the excesses of Under the Hill. In that whirlpool, even children witnessed murders and shanghaiings, and young women committing suicide and endless brawls, and he had no taste for such a life. At age 9, he had become more than cautious. He was a little Scots-German conservative, set so firmly in his ways that they would probably last a lifetime. One aspect of life under the hill he could not adjust to, the presence of so many women. It occurred to him, as he looked back upon his travels, that he and Finley, and even Campbell, had always moved where there were no women. On the trails, along the waterfront, in the stands of the Trace, it had been a man's world. Even in settled Cincinnati, when they talked with people who had been in Texas, they had met only one woman, the Arkansas lady who had fled. But now they were surrounded by young women, and he perceived that even tough men like his father and Zave sometimes wanted to be with them, those very pretty girls with only first names. And although he did not understand fully, he knew it must be all right. What irritated him, though, was that the girls sometimes showed as much interest in him as they did in Zave and his father, pampering him and petting him and offering to cut his hair. They were, he realized, doing this so as to impress Finley and Zave that they were the motherly type, and he grew quite sick of the attention. But his irritation was forgotten whenever Zave and one of the young women from the saloon took him down to the waterfront, with rifles to shoot at objects floating down the Mississippi. Then he liked it if Zave's girl cheered when he hit a bottle, and Zave did not, or when, with two quick shots, made possible by adroit reloading, he shattered two bottles. "You're a little sharpshooter," a girl said one day as she kissed him, and this he did not protest. That night, he was startled when he overheard his father proposing to a new arrival from Pennsylvania that the man purchase his Texas scrip. "Partner, I'll sell you this for half what I paid. And you can see the figures right here. 20,000 acres, $1,000 good American dollars. The newcomer said he would think it over, carefully, for his heart was set on Texas, and he visualized the 20,000 acres in terms of the ultra-rich farmland of Lancaster County. He might never find such a bargain again. Otto was distraught by his father's proposal, and he discussed it with both his teacher and Zave, and they too were appalled. The Paducah woman went boldly to McNabb and said, "You have a treasure in your son Otto. Don't waste him in this sewer. You're doing well here. I'm doing well. I have no choice. You do." 100 men have started under the hill and moved up, and I'm to be the 101st. You watch. And what in hell will you have if you do move up? Take your kid to Texas and make him a man, and take that worthless Campbell with you. Zave was even more insistent. "Finley, I'm working here only to save money to get to Texas. This is the cesspool of the world. I've just been waiting for you to say the word." "You've got a good job, Zave. I got a good job. And Otto, he's got nothing. He should be on a horse on open land, and so should you and me." One night after work, Finley broached the subject with his son. They were living in one room over Zave's saloon, where the accumulation of 18 rootless months lay scattered about. "I think, Otto, that in another year we'll have enough money to buy a house on top, a hardware store, or maybe a general one like we had in Baltimore, with a good German bakery." "People on top ain't always happy," Otto said. "Sometimes they do terrible things." "Where'd you hear that?" "Zave told me. He showed me where." "What would you like to do?" Almost defensively, the boy drew Betsy to him, cradling her head in his lap, for he was afraid to expose his true longings. But under his father's pressuring, he blurted out, like the little boy he still was, "I'd like to get aboard one of those steamboats, and stay aboard when the whistle blows, and just sail and sail, and then maybe have a horse on a great big farm where me and Betsy can run forever." Next morning, the man from Pennsylvania came to McNabb's shop and said he'd take the scrip. But Finley said quietly, "Yesterday it was for sale. Today it ain't. My son wants it." He never looked back. After giving his employer notice and receiving from him an unexpected bonus, he told Campbell to quit his job at the saloon, paid the teacher more than she expected, and bought three passages on the New Orleans steamer Clara Murphy, which would be putting into Natchez on Thursday morning, the 25th of August, 1831, on its way south from St. Louis. Otto was elated that his long-delayed dream of steaming down the river was at last coming true. And while Finley and Campbell slept amidst the deck cargo, he and Betsy walked back and forth, surveying the mystery of this great river. It was a trip into Wonderland, and he never tired of watching strange happenings along the shore. Slaves shifting bales of cotton, mules dragging a damaged boat ashore, freshly cut timbers piled sky high. That morning, still unwilling to sleep lest he missed some dramatic scene, he imagined himself as captain, maneuvering the Clara Murphy past treacherous sandbars, docking her at a plantation wharf where white women carrying umbrellas to protect them from the sun strolled aboard. Twice he chanted with the sweating black crew as they worked the boat, and he tried to hide his pleasure when they called him "Our Little Riverman." He was prepared at the end of that first glorious day to be a Mississippi man for the remainder of his life. On this trip, he saw the richness of Louisiana, for it seemed that all the wealth of the state was crowded along the shores of the river, and he perceived that families acquired fine homes with vast lawns only when they owned many slaves. Not once on this long, revealing trip did it occur to him that the slaves might have rights of their own, or that their condition in 1831 could be temporary. They were black, different in all respects, and obligated to serve their masters. New Orleans was totally different from Cincinnati and Natchez. It exuded both prosperity and pleasure, and had a relaxed spirit the other towns lacked. It was obviously very old, with strong French and Spanish accents bespeaking earlier settlers. And the mighty levees, raised high to keep the Mississippi out of the streets and homes, awed and impressed Otto. Also, there was a bustle about the city which delighted the boy, and he perceived that whereas the waterfront of Natchez had been unhealthy and unclean, that of New Orleans was vibrant and almost self-policing, as if the excesses tolerated in Under the Hill would be forbidden here. And there was burgeoning commercial activity. In one afternoon of casual exploration among the shippers, his father was offered two jobs. But Findlay had learned from his Natchez experience not to take them, lest he become entangled permanently in something he intended to engage in only temporarily. "Very well," one trader with a French name said expansively. "You're the boss. But when you get to Texas and start your plantation, remember me, Lewis Ferry, New Orleans. I'll buy your mules, your cotton, your timber." "Do all those come from Texas?" "Look at my yards. I get three parts from Louisiana, seven parts from Texas." "How do I get my produce here?" "Ships run all the time, but they're expensive. Best way is with mules. Herd them up and drove them in. Takes time, but it costs nothing." "You keep speaking about mules. Don't you accept horses?" "Rich people buy horses now and then. U.S. Army buys mules all the time." He wrote out his name and address for McNabb and added, "I've got a better idea. Put together a big herd of mules, bring them in for a good profit, and then stay with me as my manager of the Texas trade." "Where would I find the money to get the mules?" Ferry broke into laughter. "Man, in Texas the horses run wild. Mustangs, they call them. Thousands, thousands. You just go out and rope them, and they're yours." "Yes, but where do I get the mules?" "Man, you buy yourself a strong jackass, throw him in with the mares, and let him work himself to death." "What happens to the male horses?" "You drive them to New Orleans. I can always use a few." When Finley looked dubious, Ferry cried, "You ever see a Texas Mustang? I got a yard full of them, and wish I had 100 more." He led McNab to a corral, where for the first time Finley saw the powerful little horses of the Texas range, much smaller than he had expected, much finer looking than he had supposed a small horse could be. "They run wild?" He studied them carefully, exercising his eye, trained among the great horses of Ireland, then said, "They told me in Natchez that cattle run wild, too." Ferry clapped him vigorously on the shoulder. "In Texas, everything runs wild. You just reach out and grab." "Why aren't you in Texas?" "Because it's a wilderness. Not a decent place to eat in the whole damned province. And besides, it's a Mexican wilderness. And who wants to live in a country that can't govern itself?" "Some Americans seem to like it." "Right. Right. And if I was that kind of American, I might like it, too." "What kind of American are you speaking of?" "An American like you. Energy, courage, stars in your eyes, and willingness to live alone. Because, man, Texas is empty. Just wild cattle and untamed horses." As he said this, the young man who had brought the Mustangs to New Orleans appeared in the corral, and as soon as Otto saw him, he was captivated, for the herdsman was the first Mexican he had met. He was in his mid-twenties, whip-thin, dark-skinned, and clad in the distinctive uniform of the range. Tight blue pants marked by a tiny white stripe, bandana, big hat, boots, and spurs. To Otto, he looked the way a Texan should. "Show them how you ride," Ferry ordered. And with just a slight flare of resentment at being spoken to as if he were a peasant, the young man flicked the brim of his hat almost insolently, but then smiled warmly at Otto. "Is the young man good with the horse?" "I can ride," Otto said. And the young Mexican whistled to one of his assistants, "Manuel, traen los dos caballos buenos." From a hitching rail near the corral, Manuel untied two horses already saddled, and deftly the young man lifted himself onto the larger one, indicating that Otto should mount his, which the boy did rather clumsily. The Mexican then began to canter about the stable area, shouting to Otto, "Follow me!" And a delightful comedy ensued. For the Mexican rode with skill, swinging and swaying with the motion of his horse like a practiced professional, while the boy tried energetically to keep up, slipping and sliding and nearly falling from his mount. But he did hold on, grabbing his horse's mane when necessary. Ferry, Findlay, and Campbell applauded the exhibition, whereupon the Mexican rider broke loose from Otto's comical trailing to perform a series of beautiful feats, ending with a full gallop at Campbell, bringing his steed to a halt a few inches from the Kaintuck's toes. "The boy could learn to ride," he said as he dismounted. And when Otto came up awkwardly, the Mexican helped him dismount and asked, "Son, you want to ride back to Texas with me and help me bring another remuda up for Don Luis?" "Oh," Otto cried with enthusiasm, "that would be wonderful." "Who is this young horseman?" the senior McNab asked. And as the rider continued talking with Otto, Ferry said, "Young Mexican from Victoria, South Texas. Absolutely trustworthy. What he says he'll do, he does." "He brought you all these animals?" "He did." "Where did he get them?" "In this business, you never ask." "What's your name, young fellow?" McNab asked. "Garza," the rider said, smiling. "Benito Garza." He pronounced each syllable carefully, drawing it out in the Mexican way. Benito Garza, with exaggerated accent on the knee and gar. Having introduced himself verbally, he did so symbolically with another flick of his finger against the brim of his big hat. And with that, he disappeared into the stables. At the inn where they were staying prior to arranging passage to their new lands, the McNabs and Campbell met two authentic residents of Texas, well-educated plantation owners who had come to New Orleans to arrange for the sale of their products on a regular basis. After they had reached an understanding with Louis Ferry, whom they lauded as the best man in the business, they chatted about aspects of their new home. We have great men in Texas, equal of any in Massachusetts or Virginia. We plan to erect a notable state with all the advantages of South Carolina or Georgia. There's a spaciousness to our view. We can see clear to the Pacific Ocean, and a nobility to our minds because we're determined to build a new society. Everything is of a vast dimension, and we need men with vast potential to help us achieve what we've planned. Weaklings will be erased by the climate and the distance, if by nothing else. But the strong will find themselves growing even stronger. Any young man of promise who doesn't catch the first boat to Texas is an idiot. When Finley raised several questions about things that disturbed him, the two men laughed them off. The Frenchman said the food was inedible. He's right, abominable, but it can only get better. The Arkansas woman fled because of loneliness? She was surely right. My nearest neighbor is 40 miles away, and I don't want him any closer because then he'd be on my land. But when Finley voiced serious doubts about the instability of the Mexican government, he noticed that the men became evasive. And he was about to find out whether they favored the ultimate incorporation of Texas into the American Union when the men changed the subject dramatically. The leader, spreading his hands on the table, asked energetically, "And where do you propose settling?" "I was about to ask your advice." "Nacogdoches, up here. Victoria, down here. Both places wonderful for an energetic man, which I take you to be. But any reasonable place in between is just as good." "Where are you?" "I'm down here, at the mouth of the Brazos River. My brother-in-law, he's up here at Nacogdoches." "Where should I go?" "Wherever the ship deposits you. Landing in Texas is not easy. Sometimes the ship can make one spot, sometimes another." "How much land you taking up?" "I've bought myself 20,000 acres. One of the men whistled. "That's a mighty spread. How'd you hook it?" Proudly, McNabb opened his papers, showing the men his authority for the occupation of 20,000 acres, as approved by the Mexican government in any likely area. The men studied the papers, then looked at each other and said nothing. Pushing the documents back to McNabb, they changed the subject to shipping. "What you must do is catch a steamboat that goes to the mouth of the Mississippi. A sailing ship will be waiting there to carry you to Texas." "Why don't the steamboats go all the way?" "They've tried it. Too many wrecks. It's never easy to enter Texas." "Where should I head for?" "We told you. Wherever the ship lands you, it's all good." When Finley was back in his room, he pondered the suspicious manner in which the men had reacted to his papers, and he began to worry that his documents might be faulty. So well after midnight, he ascertained where the men were sleeping and went to their room, knocking loudly until one of the men opened the door. "I apologize, but this is terribly important to me. Is something wrong with my papers?" "No, no, they're in good shape." The man tried to close the door, but Finley kept it open. "They're not, and I saw it clearly in your eyes when you looked at them. You must tell me." There was no light in the room, but the man propped open the door and invited McNabb to sit on his bed while he sat on the bed of his brother-in-law. Painfully, hesitantly, they told McNabb the truth. "Your papers are a fraud. We see it all the time." "You mean?" "No standing at all in Mexico. Land isn't given out that way. That traveler in the next room, without a single sheet of paper, has as good a chance as you of getting land in Texas." "How can such a thing be allowed?" "Two different countries. Your fake company is in the United States. The land is in Mexico." "My God, $1,000. In anguish, McNabb leaped from the bed. "Completely lost," the man said. But when McNabb groaned, the men both spoke in rushes of encouraging words. "I didn't mean that everything is lost. You can still get land, excellent land, but never 20,000 acres.
You get it free, absolutely free.
After this burst of warm reassurance, one of the men pressed Findlay to sit back down, then patiently helped as his brother-in-law explained the situation. You land in Texas wherever the ship drops you, and you establish contact with the Mexican officials. Being Scotch, I suppose you're Protestant, so you volunteer to convert to Catholicism. We're both Catholics legally, but we're really Baptists. Conversion entitles you to 1,000 acres of land, maybe a little more because of your son. The big fellow with you, he can get the same. If you're lucky enough to be unmarried and can find a Mexican girl to marry, you could very well get yourself a league and a labor, and that's a lot of land. Or you could buy land from someone like the two of us who already has his league and labor. I have three, he has two. We have none for sale, but it goes for about 20 cents an acre, and it can be very good land. Maybe 50 cents for bottom land along the river, and I'd advise you to get some of that. Or you can apply to one of the great empresarios, who already have legal title to enormous reaches of land, and you can get that for almost nothing, and sometimes for nothing at all, because they want settlers. I got mine in three different ways. Mexican government gave me some, I bought some, and Stephen Austin, as fine a man as you'll ever meet, he was so anxious to get settlers on his properties that he gave me a large plot. Originally, one bit here, one bit up here, and one bit way down there. But I traded even till I had them side by side, and now I have 15,000 acres for a little over $2,000. You can do the same. The man on the bed asked in the darkness, "Are you married, McNabb?" And after the slightest hesitation, Findlay replied, "No." They were pleased at this information, for it meant that, if all else failed, he could marry a Mexican woman and get a quadruple portion. "Why do they make it so complicated?" he asked. "With Mexicans, nothing is ever allowed to be simple." A rickety old steamboat carried 30 American adults, 9 children, and 22 slaves down the tortuously winding Mississippi south of New Orleans. Passengers marveled as they crept past beautiful moss-hung plantations of the lesser sort, for, as a deckhand explained, if and they got money, they has a plantation above New Orleans, not below. Here the air hung heavy, and insects droned in the heat, as travelers prayed for some vagrant breeze to slip in from the Gulf of Mexico. Entire sections of land became swamps, inhabited only by birds and alligators. Swamps interminable. Until at last the steamboat reached the strangest termination of any of the world's major rivers, a bewildering morass of passes seeking the Gulf, of blind alleys leading only to more swampland. Often it was impossible to determine whether the area ahead was freshwater river, or saltwater gulf, or firm land, or simply more weed-grown swamp. "How can he tell his way?" Otto asked one of the deckhands. "By smell." The answer was not entirely frivolous, for as the great river died, the smell of the vast, free gulf intruded, and soon Otto himself could detect the larger body of water. As soon as the vessel waiting in the gulf became aware of the approaching steamer, its captain fired a small cannon to signify that all was in readiness, and Otto, seeing for the first time an ocean-going craft, shouted, "There she is!" These last days had been a journey through a primeval wonderland, more challenging by far than that along the river to the north of New Orleans, and to see the sloop Carthaginian waiting motionless at the end of the passage was like seeing a light in the forest. As they threw ropes to the steamer, sailors shouted the good news, "We sail for Galveston," and travelers who had hoped to make that important landing cheered. Fare to Texas would be $21 total, 5 paid to the steamboat, 16 to the sail-borne sloop. But no transfer from one craft to another was ever made easily, no matter how gentle the sea. And now, when the steamboat dipped slightly, the sloop lifted and contrariwise. Shins were barked and baggage imperiled, but finally the adults were safe aboard the vessel. The children could be handed across, and the slaves were able to follow. The returning steamboat, having picked up passengers for New Orleans, blew its whistle three times in farewell. The emigrants cheered, and the trip across the Gulf was begun, with the passengers having only the slightest comprehension of their destination. "We're making for Galveston," an officer explained. "But if the weather's bad, we may have to put in at Matagorda Bay." Galveston was some 400 miles, almost due west, and since there was a sharp breeze from the southeast, the ship could make 4 knots, or about 110 land miles a day. "The trip won't require more than 4 days," the officer assured the passengers, "and I doubt that it'll be rough." Otto loved the swaying of the ship, and whereas some of the passengers experienced a slight seasickness, he roamed everywhere and ate large quantities of everything. It was a holiday for him, but some of the travelers were agitated by the uncertainty of destination. "We hoped to put in at Matagorda. Our people are there." "You can walk from Galveston to Matagorda," a sailor said easily, as if the trip were a matter of hours. "Why can't we go direct to Matagorda?" "Because on this passage we never know. I don't even know if and we'll be able to land in Galveston." "What kind of ship is this?" one man growled. "It ain't the ship. It's Texas." And the sailor outlined the problem. "Texas is a great land, I'm sure. It's got everything a man might want. Free land, free cattle, beautiful rivers, and mountains, too, I hear, in the west. But one thing it ain't got is a safe harbor. None. It has fine big bays, best in the world. Galveston, Matagorda, Corpus, Laguna Madre. I've been in them all, and they ain't none better. Only one thing wrong with them. No way you can get into them. God made hisself these perfect bays, then guarded them with strings of sandbars, half-assed islands, marshes, and every other kind of impediment you could imagine. This is maybe the most dangerous coastline in the whole damned world. Well, look at the wrecks we'll see when we try to get into one of them bays. Wrecks everywhere. First steamboat tried it, wrecked. Next steamboat went aground, and you'll see it rotten there if and we're driven to Matagorda. The coast of Texas is hell in salt water. The weather remained good, the sloop did make for Galveston, and the same sailor came back with one bit of comforting news. "Maybe I overdone it. This is a mighty tough coast, as you'll see, but one worry we don't have. They ain't no Beetland rocks stacked ashore, and they ain't none hidin' submerged to rip out your bottom. Anything you hit is soft sand." But he returned a few minutes later with a correction. "Of course, most of the wrecks you'll see did just that. They hit soft sand, held fast, and then turned over." Otto noticed that he never said what happened to the passengers.